McGill Daily of The Daily.
I'm McGill Daily.
Hi, I'm calling from The McGill Daily. Can I ask you some questions?
This is a little bit problematic.
News. Could I see you for a second?
We're going to cap this.
News, can you dummy?
Did that story come in yet?
Editorial is in 5 minutes.
McGill Daily.
Unfit to print.
You're listening to Unfit to Print, a McGill Daily and CKUT news collaboration. I'm your host, Chantel Schultz. Unfit to Print is a student-produced, bi-weekly show that brings the latest of McGill and Montreal news. The first half of this week's segment will be excerpts from the roundtable discussion on October 26th titled Lived Experiences of Trans Women of Color and Law. The event was organized by Outlaw and the Women of Color Collective of McGill Law, and focused on the experiences of trans women migrants and of the speakers Betty Iglesias and Dahlia Turki. The discussion was moderated by Florence Perret. Then you'll hear an interview with Amir George, co-creator and curator of Black Radical Imagination, a touring film project that screens short films by Black filmmakers and creatives. Articule hosted a screening of this year's Black Radical Imagination program on October 30th. But first, headlines. On October 25th, about 15 students and other members of the McGill community met for a town hall meeting to talk about McGill's draft smoking on campus policy. The policy was developed following consultation with the McGill community that was initiated by the Student Society of McGill University, SMU, and the Postgraduate Student Society, PGSS, of McGill University. According to the draft of the policy, smoking would be banned on the downtown campus except for a designated area at the upper residences and designated areas on McDonald campus and the Galt Estate. Students at the town hall brought up stigmatization of smokers and security issues for students having to leave campus to smoke at night. A recently released provincial government report revealed that many Quebec University buildings are in poor condition, especially those at McGill, which received the worst grade from provincial building inspectors. The report stated that 73% of the buildings at McGill are in poor or worse condition. In comparison, 60% of the buildings at Concordia and l'Université de Montréal have been assessed as being in need of urgent renovations. According to Associate Vice Principal University Services, Robert Couvrette, 27% of McGill's buildings received an E grade, which is the lowest grade a building in Quebec can receive. In a collective statement, the Student Society of McGill University, SMU, told The Daily that we need to see a stronger funding commitment from the government to address these problems at all Quebec universities. More than 1,000 people gathered at Place Émilie Gamelin for a demonstration against rape culture on the evening of October 26th. The demonstration was organized partially to respond to recent high-profile sexual assault cases in Quebec, and those in attendance either supported or were themselves people who had experienced sexual violence. Speakers spoke about the importance of intersectionality, of acknowledging that sexual violence and rape disproportionately affect women, especially Indigenous women. Speakers also called for solidarity from those wanting to support those who've experienced sexual violence, including organizing demonstrations, writing articles, and donating to funds for survivors. You'll now hear excerpts from the roundtable discussion on October 26th titled Lived Experiences of Trans Women of Color and Law. The discussion was organized by Outlaw, a club for queer students and their allies based in the Faculty of Law, and the Women of Color Collective of McGill Law. The event focused on the experiences of trans women migrants and of the speakers, Betty Iglesias and Dahlia Turki. Iglesias has worked in the Montreal area doing outreach and providing resources for trans people, sex workers, and LGBTQ immigrants in Quebec. Turki is an advocate for trans migrants' rights and helped organize the Trans March this year. The discussion was moderated by Florence Perret, who is intern for the Trans Legal Clinic and is the VP External for Outlaw and head French editor for Contours, Voices of Women in Law. The panelists discussed Quebec Bills 35 and 103, which allow trans citizens, both adults and minors, to change their legal name and gender marker without undergoing genital surgery. Trans migrants are excluded from these laws and do not have these rights. Perret asked what problems trans migrants face with Quebec law. Iglesias answered first.
What are the main challenges faced by trans women of color and by trans migrants with the law in Quebec?
I mean, for trans migrants who face, like, you know, like, kind of, you know, like discrimination, exclusion, inaccessibility to essential services, like with this, like bringing all this luggage and big expectation about having like better conditions in terms of healthcare access, housing, like it's still difficult because part of the justice still is the legal name and IDs and segmentations, which are like one of the bigger intersections to access housing, whether are shelters, where are like, I don't know, apartments, you know, like living in, you know, like with other people sometimes, you know, difficult. And also we go through sometimes this need of mental health care, right? Like, and it's not something that you know, like, you know, at the beginning, that's something that you are finding out, and through the resources, through the supporting groups, or through, you know, like self-researches, like the researches we do by ourselves. Yes, I mean, when we are talking about rights, it's there are rights where we are still discriminated. Why? Because credibility, because the demands are really specific and we don't have access to provide that kind of criteria, like documents or papers, because we don't have access to it. In case, in this part of the most precarious part of the precarious, I know, like, we have refugee claimants who arrived here after a system that completely changed since 2012 because of the law C31. I come from Mexico, and I came in 2009. I navigated in a very different system, and I witnessed just like people like me, we were going through difficulties in terms of recognition of gender identity and gender expression. That's something that the Citizenship and Immigration Canada modified just recently. Like, these are changes that probably they are implementing just now. But in 2014, the CCR, the Canadian Council of Refugees, they made this resolution supporting trans refugees because we denounced it, like we denounced in front of them, like we need documents that allowed us to have access to essential healthcare, to the housing, to don't have to explain, you know, about your gender, your identity, because people, they, one of the biggest things I think is like when they have this privilege, right? Like this power over the decision to give you access or not.
Next, you'll hear Dahlia Torkey's response to the question, what problems do trans migrants face with Quebec law?
So I'd like first to explain what's wrong with the Article 71 from the from Quebec's civil code. It basically forbids trans people from changing their documents, their legal documents. So basically, if you're a trans woman, like me, you still have your dead name on the document. You cannot change it. So basically, I still have a masculine name that I was given at birth when I did not choose. I still have male as gender designation. So basically, for a cisgender person to go to post office, a library, hospital, any institution is something that is very easy. Like showing an ID card, it's not any source of embarrassment or anything. But to me, for instance, just going to a place like, you know, ask for any simple service is just like creates a sense of malaise. It creates a sense of embarrassment. You know, I've never had the level of anxiety that I've been having these past few months. I mean, it's also like intersection of different factors, but this factor, like not being able to have simple, basic services and having to go through this whole process of like, you know, every time I show my ID, I'm being outed. So, and when I'm outed, sometimes some people just like accuse me of identity usurpation. Like, you know, you go to a post office to claim a parcel that you received and the person tells you, oh, it's not you. Here, I can say it's like male and it's not you. And then I have to say that I'm trans, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like saying this in the context of like going to a post office. It's even harder when you're, you know, going to, when you want to rent a place, like when it comes to housing, when it comes to finding a job. Finding a job is not easy at all when you're a trans person who does not have documents that match your identity. Health services, I've had people, like doctors telling me that they do not treat or they do not work, like do not, you know, offer service to people like me, you know. And this basically goes back again to, I mean, I don't want to make it sound as if having documents that match our identities is the ultimate goal, and once we have documents, oh, that's like our final standing. Because like, I know lots of like trans people who have documents, but transphobia is, not, is still there, mainly for people who do not pass. I mean, I do have the privilege of passing. Some people do not have that privilege, but again, that privilege or any, you know, passing is like totally annihilated whenever I show an ID.
Trans migrants are present in Quebec in a variety of contexts. So you have people who come as students, as refugees, as temporary workers, as family members of citizens, as skilled workers, etc. Do all those groups have very different difficulties? Do they share a lot of similarities in their difficulties, and what are the difficulties they face?
Well, I do not think that, well, let's first start by saying that there is substantial difficulty regardless of the immigration status or the immigration process that the person went through. But I would think of it as being really specific to the case, individual cases, but of course there are, like, the unfortunate ones will deal with, you know, extremely violent conditions. You know, for refugees, for instance, if you're lucky, they will let you enter Canada without having to go through detention centers. If you're not lucky, well, then you go through a detention center. If you had no luck at all, well, they will put you in the wrong detention center. Like for a trans woman, they will put you in a detention center for men, and then you have to find strategies not to be raped, for instance. Because when you're a trans immigrant, you really develop survival strategies in order to be able to navigate transphobic systems. I mean, it should be way simpler and way easier. You know, coming here to Canada, I would think of like how to you know, think about integration, how to get you to learn your country, your languages, your weather, things like that. You don't think about like, oh, how am I gonna survive? You know, applying for permanent residency, getting accepted. How am I gonna survive if I'm not gonna be accepted to be a Quebec resident? Yeah, especially knowing that if you come back to Tunisia, where I come from, well then, you know, it's not easy at all.
Yeah, well, basically, my approach has been more with people with the papers, refugee claimants, and protected persons, if they can, you know, like, so basically, most of the people I have been working with, and I consider myself also, we have worked in the sex industry, right, like sex working, and there are so many reasons why we choose to sex work. It's because we may like it, because we need it, even we don't like it, or, you know, in terms of surviving, but also some people, they really want to transition, and it's really difficult because they don't have access. Like, medical resources in Montreal are not enough for trans people, and having access to these resources is complicated. So, transition can be like surgery, hormones. So, some sex workers, they decide to cover their expenses. They decide to save money and cover the breast implants. They want to save money and cover their hormones, probably from the black market. Which, in terms of trans health, that's why, you know, like, we aim to promote to work on harm reduction. So these are part of the struggles. But what happens when comes person is arrested or persons have struggles with police? Like, we still see, after all these changes in the law, you know, like in sex work, after C36, and they say, well, now we're gonna criminalize clients, but still the police profile trans people in the street because they look trans, and they assume all trans people in the street made sex work, so they are still harassed by the police. They're still arrested. So one of the most of the biggest issues is when they are incarcerated, or, and also, like when Dalia mentioned, like detention center, I have not seen really a trans woman, you know, in like being detained with men, not even with women. They are just segregated. Yeah, and they don't see anyone. So there are some things deal, right, in terms of these punishments, like the punishment, but like if a trans woman who sex work is incarcerated as in prison, and then she's migrant, she can be like have no papers, she can be a refugee claimant, or you know, like she can be deported. So that's one of the biggest issues we are still struggle, because they are considered criminals, they are considered dangerous, so they are not the good fit for society, and it's easier for, you know, to kind of to send them back to the countries of origin. Even they made a refugee claim based off, you know, the struggles they did in the countries.
Paré asked the panelists, what are some things trans migrants want, and how can people help make those things happen, especially those in the law faculty?
As I said earlier, having documents that match our identity is one of the goals. It's not the main goal. Like, the fight is not going to end with documents that match our identity. As long as there are trans people who are being murdered, especially trans women of color, the fight is not going to end. It's a necessity. Like, discriminating between trans Canadians and trans migrants should not be acceptable in a country that pretends to be, you know, fighting for human rights, a safe haven for the LGBT community. Safe haven for gay community, yes. It's not a safe haven for trans communities that's coming from other countries. So first of all, like, there shouldn't even be like a meeting with the minister. I mean, we're gonna have to do that. We're gonna have to go through that, meet with her, and like do this, what we're doing right now. You know, talking about our lives and why we need these changes to be done, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. But to me, it doesn't even have to take place. It's a fact. Trans migrants like must have those documents. There shouldn't be any discrimination between a white trans person who has documents and an immigrant one who doesn't have documents, especially that the latter has more, like, I mean, we have race, like, we suffer from racism, we suffer from, like, having to adapt when you're in your country, we suffer from letting go, we were obliged to let go our homelands. I mean, we paid huge prices, like, not thinking that you cannot come back to Tunisia, or thinking that you cannot come back somewhere where you belong and there is still part of yourself, is really destroying. I'm not trying to undermine the experience of white trans people or like Canadian trans people, but I do see that the experience of like immigrants and trans people of color is even more difficult. And just like helping them with documents is not like much to be asked. Another thing, we need laws that protect us at workplace. We need laws that protect us at, like, you know, wherever we are. Trans people need to be, trans migrants need to be put at the front of the marches of the organizations.
You just heard excerpts from the panel, Lived Experiences of Trans Women of Color in Law, with speakers Betty Iglesias and Dahlia Torkey. Now you'll hear an interview with Amir George, co-creator and curator of Black Radical Imagination, a touring film project that screens short films by Black filmmakers and creatives. George was present at the screening of this year's program at Articule on October 30th. Why did you create Black Radical Imagination, and what is it?
Black Radical Imagination is created by myself and Erin Cristobal. She's based in L.A. We're both like film programmers. We like met through like a mutual friend who moved to Chicago, suggested I get in contact with her. She was in L.A. doing like similar work. And we were talking about everything that pretty much like didn't exist as far as like Black film programming and things we were seeing done in, you know, the Black film world and the exhibition of work and things like that. And we decided to put this program together to like speak to that, to speak to this like lack of representation of Black bodies on screen and so many things attached to that, that what we weren't seeing and what we wanted to see. So it was like starting off with different concepts that we wanted to play off of and find films that fit. And yeah, we've been going for about like 4 years right now since we first had our first conversation. And it's barely about the exhibition of Black short films made by Black visual artists and filmmakers. Ultimately, the program speaks to the marginalization of people of color in the film industry, but it's like a global thing, you know. Coming here to Montreal again, the first time we was here, it was the first time we had a chance to see, to talk about like Blackness on a global level and how people related to the films that aren't American and don't deal with things that like Black people have to endure in America, and also thinking about how it's a worldwide marginalization of people of color on a screen and access to equipment and making films. So, yeah.
So what are some representations that you weren't seeing in film? And
well, just in like a positive image, just a Black body in a positive image in a way that makes people happy, you know, and think positively. So many films that come out and, you know, a Black person is made to look a certain way, and historically, like, that's how Black people have been treated in films, just as this bad, you know, person, this bad visual. So we wanted films that were the opposite of that, and that were new contemporary films, and that were just made from the imagination. Really, our title stems from a book by an author named Robin D.G. Kelly, Freedom Dreams of Black Radical Imagination. And in that book, he speaks about these different like social movements that came about purely inspired by the like imagination. So we wanted to speak to that in contemporary filmmaking on a level of like short films, on a scale of short films, to where those are the most underseen, where you have larger, bigger films that get more attention, and short films is kind of like left on the film festival circuit and left to just exist out there. So we wanted to give more of an avenue to underseen films and more of another opportunity for like makers to like exhibit outside of the normal like festival circuit.
So how do you choose the films?
Me and Erin basically have long phone conversations. Not that long. Like, we kind of have our intentions set on just being that we've done this for multiple years. At this point, we just want to have a more interesting program than the previous year. So it's just like building on what we already have created and having more visuals and meeting new filmmakers all the time and discovering new work. We just talk about like it's things we see that we may come in contact with from friends. People send us things. Three of the filmmakers that was in tonight's program, we all met them like a year ago. So it was like from then to now, and you know, what we were able to do and the work that we're making. It's really about the work that's being made that allows us to do the work that we're doing.
So how has Black Radical Imagination impacted and shaped by Afrofuturism and Afro-Surrealism? And can you talk about these concepts?
Afrofuturism was an initial theme we used with identifying the films in the first program. Being that we wanted to see more content like that, dealt with the Black people within, like, a like futuristic context. With Afro-Surrealism, That was a coin term by a writer at the Bay Area named D. Scott Miller, who wrote a manifesto called the Afro-Surrealist Manifesto, where it basically dealt with more or less like black spirituality. So Afrofuturism and Afro-Surrealism, these were two terms that we started with the first films we brought upon the project, and just expanding on that to say the magnificent is just beautiful blackness, ultimately. It's just, you know, all that exists beyond the realm of, within the realm of the imagination. So, yeah, it's taking its form. We don't particularly consider all the films to be Afro-Surrealist or consider all the films to be Afro-Futurist. It's just like, it's just kind of like a something that's there, underlining thing of all of them. They have some type of relation to those terms, drawing on them being the relations to blackness.
You and the other curator are both from the U.S.
Yeah.
So why is it important to have artists from all of the black diaspora and not just the U.S.?
Because blackness is global, and that was just something we had. We were thankful to have the opportunity to be in contact with these other artists. Yeah, I mean, like, first place we were at, like, Trinidad. We had a film from there. Then we had an artist from Denmark 1 year, Jeanette Ellers. So, yeah, I mean, being able to work with people who identify as black but are from a different parts of the country, being that it's very important to Black Rock Imagination as a project, because it just shows you, like, the work that's being made all over about black people and from black people, about black people.
What is the future of Black Radical Imagination? What are your plans? Do you ever plan on screening things that are not just short films?
Right now, we're just a short film program. I imagine we'll grow to, I don't know. It's unlimited, whatever we imagine and decide to act upon. But we will continue touring. We have other screenings coming up in the States. That we're excited to do, and excited to bring short films and allow the filmmakers we've been working with to have other opportunities of exhibition, and all institutions that have such an interest in our work, and just keeps growing.
Is there anything else that you'd like to say about the project?
Stay radical, keep the imagination alive. BlackRadicalImagination.com.
You just heard an interview with Amir George, co-creator of Black Radical Imagination. That's all for this edition of Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM. Make sure to tune in 2 weeks to hear our next episode. And in the meantime, check out our previous coverage and podcasts at mcgilldaily.com/podcast or pick up a print copy on stands now. Unfit to Print.